It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a federal judge shut down work rules for Medicaid recipients in Kentucky and Arkansas. We talk with a Wisconsin health policy researcher about whether these cases could affect us here in the state. First, most nutrition researchers say we can boost our health by eating more of a plant-based diet. And with warmer weather on the way, more fresh produce is going to make it a lot easier to do that. On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guests say plant-based meals can be delicious for vegans, vegetarians, and everyone else. Katie Cotin is the founder, photographer, and meal planner behind Well Vegan, a vegan meal planning service that makes it easy and affordable to follow a plant-based diet. Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Kate Casby is the recipe developer and content creator behind Well Vegan. They've also written a cookbook together. It's called Frugal Vegan. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand you both have Midwestern roots. You're both working over on the West Coast now. Kate, what do you think? Is it hard to pull off a vegan or mostly vegan diet in a dairy and meat-friendly state like Wisconsin?
It's not impossible. You just have to be a little bit creative with seasonal produce and some basic pantry staples. It's really not that hard.
And Katie, I think a lot of people think, okay, eating more plants sounds great. It doesn't sound as yummy as I usually eat. Is it possible to go more plant-based, even if we don't go full vegan, and still enjoy our food a lot?
Absolutely. It's a progressive transition. It's not something you have to do all at once.
Yeah, Katie, how much did you change your approach to eating when you decided to try a vegan diet? What were some of the steps you took along the way?
Well, as a starting point, I was a vegetarian, so the transition was a little bit easier. But I started with recipes that I was already comfortable with and that I enjoyed, and I made slight adjustments to make them vegan. So, for instance, if you were an omnivore and you had a soup that you enjoyed that was vegetable-based but made with chicken stock, you could make an easy swap for vegetable stock. Another easy thing to do is with Mexican food, you can swap out the dairy with other creamy additions like avocado or guacamole.
And Kate, I think for a lot of people who do eat meat, when we cook, we kind of start with the entree, and a lot of times that entree is meat, and then we build a meal around that. How can we make our plans, how can we plan our meals, even if it's just like the meatless Monday or that one or two meals a week where we leave meat off the table, how can we get started on planning that that meal agenda?
That's a great question. Well, for me, I love pasta, and coming from the Midwest, we ate pasta probably five nights a week. So that was a very relatable thing that I could take from my omnivore lifestyle into my vegan lifestyle. So instead of eating pasta with meatballs, maybe try eating pasta with some sauteed veggies and kind of making swaps like that. That's a really easy way to kind of plan your week. And you can always keep pasta stocked in your pantry. So it's something that you can always have on hand, even in those hungry emergencies.
We're talking to Kate Casby and Katie Cotin with the website Well Vegan. We're doing some plant-based cooking on this edition of Food Friday. As always, we have some recipes for our guests over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's get into one of those recipes now. We've got a lentil one that you shared with us. I used to make lentils a lot back in the day. I called it lentil glop. It tasted pretty good. As you can guess from the name, it didn't look like much. I think people maybe have a bad attitude sometimes toward the humble lentil. Katie, talk about, first, before we get into the recipe, just talk about the power of the lentil.
Oh, absolutely. And lentils are a great swap for a lot of meat or protein in your diet. They can be used in red sauces as kind of a substitute for ground meat without that extra texture and protein. But here in this lentil and rice salad, it's an attractive addition. It's not going to be your glop. So you want to just make sure, and when you're cooking your lentils, you don't cook them to mush. You want to get a firm lentil, like a French lentil, so it holds its shape, especially in a salad. And with the addition of the vegetables, it really adds a lot of brightness and color.
And this is, Kate, a lentil and wild rice salad with vegetables. So you're hitting a Midwestern sweet spot with that wild rice. Talk about that as an ingredient.
Yeah, well, wild rice was a strategic ingredient because it does have a really nice, dense, chewy texture. It lends itself really nicely to a salad. You're not going to have that kind of like starchy stickiness that you would get from maybe a white rice or brown rice. And it's also packed with nutrients. So you're getting, in addition to the vegetables, you're getting some more micronutrients there as well.
And Katie, talk about how this recipe comes together a little bit, the lentil and wild rice salad with veggies.
Oh, absolutely. So basically, you're just going to cook your lentils and your wild rice separately. And you, from there, you're going to make a simple dressing and briefly cook your vegetables very simply and toss it all together. And it keeps really well. So you can make it in advance, and it's good if it's warm or cold. So it's very adaptable.
Yeah, you've got some more, I don't want to say tougher, but like more durable vegetables in it. It's not like fragile salad greens that are going to wilt on the way to the potluck or whatever.
Absolutely. Like for Kate and I, we really like to meal plan and cook ahead as much as possible for our weeks. It really helps with adhering to like a plant-based diet as well. So anything we can make ahead that keeps well is a priority.
Now, Kate, we love wild rice here, but it isn't always available on the shelves. Are there backup plans if we don't have that wild rice around for this one?
Sure. I would suggest brown rice. At Well Vegan, we typically avoid white rice because it doesn't have the nutritional profile that some of the other grains do. So brown rice would be great. Also quinoa, that would add some nice protein.
And Katie, I think I saw in this recipe, I didn't even know you could do this. You can buy pre-cooked lentils?
Yeah, absolutely. If you have a Trader Joe's nearby, in their cold case section, there's steam lentils. And other grocery stores provide them as well.
And they taste just as good as if we cooked them at home?
Yeah, absolutely. I would avoid, say, a lentil in a can. But the cold ones in the cold case that are vacuum packed, those are great.
All right, let's shift gears a little to breakfast now. We actually recently had a Food Friday about pancakes, and you're adding to our pancake arsenal now a vegan recipe, pancakes with roasted bananas. Kate, roasting bananas. I have not done this.
Roasting bananas is life-changing.
Really?
Putting them in the oven really, it gives them that caramelized flavor and just brings out the sweetness even more. It's a great, great topping for a sweet breakfast.
And I'll usually use eggs and milk, of course, when I make pancakes. Katie, what keeps my pancakes fluffy without the dairy and eggs?
Without the dairy and eggs, we're just going to rely on some plant-based milks and some baking powder. And that'll give you a little fluff.
Okay. And the bananas roasted with maple syrup. So that's, once again, you hit us with a good Midwestern thing, though I guess we'd always put syrup on our pancakes. But I like the pre-making the bananas with the maple syrup. That, did you come up with that on your own? I'd never heard of that.
Yeah, I believe I did. I was just like, oh, well, you would normally put bananas in pancakes and syrup on top. So right. Why not combine both of them and make a delicious mess in the oven?
That sounds great. And I know, notice with your, a lot of your recipes, like the ones we have at WPR.org/Food Friday, a lot of the ingredients are pretty straightforward. You don't need to go to really specialty stores to buy a lot of this. Is this, Kate, something you try to do?
Definitely. Our approach to cooking, we want to make it as simple as possible. A lot of the people who read our blog are really looking for affordable recipes with ingredients that they can get pretty much anywhere. So that's the way that I tend to cook. And then those are the recipes we like to share.
Yeah. And Katie, you, the two of you had this cookbook, A Frugal Vegan. Talk about the frugal angle a little more.
Yeah, absolutely. So being frugal is kind of perceived to be a challenge on a vegan diet. But we've really found that if you just eat with the seasons and you eat with the produce that's available to you and you're eating whole foods and you're not eating processed foods, that it's really easy and affordable to do. So we kind of crafted all the recipes in the book around that idea. So for instance, the pancakes with roasted bananas is one of the recipes from the book. And your base of your pancake is just all your pantry staples that you already have, and bananas are incredibly inexpensive. So it's just, it's easy way to pull together quick and affordable recipes.
We're talking to Katie Cotin and Kate Casby, creators of the website Well Vegan. Their cookbook is called Frugal Vegan. They're sharing some easy-to-make, delicious plant-based meals with us today for vegans, vegetarians, and anyone. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite meal to make when you want a break, maybe from a meat or dairy-based recipe repertoire? Are you a vegan or a vegetarian yourself? What have been some of your favorite go-tos? What were some of your challenges? Do you have a question for our guests about making great vegan meals? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a few of the recipes that Katie and Kate have shared with us. You can do that over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Katie Cotin and Kate Casby, creators of the website Well Vegan and co-authors of the cookbook Frugal Vegan. They're sharing some recipes and ideas for vegan-friendly meals that everyone can enjoy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to follow a more plant-based diet, whether that means you're vegan, vegetarian, or just take a break from meat and dairy every now and then? What are some of your go-to meals or cooking ideas you've had? Or do you have a question for our guests, some ideas that you need, some problems you've run into that they could maybe solve for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a few recipes they've shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll go to your calls now. TJ is with us in Fort Atkinson. TJ, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, TJ?
I wanted to see if they knew about a recipe back from the Depression age that's usually called crazy cake, but some people call it wacky cake.
And what is that, TJ?
It's a wonderful chocolate cake, and it's absolutely vegan. And we found it because my daughter is allergic to milk and eggs and also peanuts.
Okay, and I heard a strong yes there. Run with that.
Yes. On the website, we have my grandmother's version of the wacky cake that she had shared in one of her old church group cookbooks. And that was one of the first recipes we had on Well Vegan.
No kidding.
That's great. It's all about that idea of starting with what you know and what's already vegan.
And so how does this come together, the chocolate wacky cake?
Oh, goodness. It's been a while since I've made it, but I'll try and remember. It's flour, cocoa powder, baking powder, oil. I feel like there's another ingredient I'm forgetting, but it's all very basic pantry things and all inexpensive because it was adapted in the Depression.
And Katie, is this yummy?
It's delicious.
Awesome.
It's really moist and easy to make.
That's great. TJ, thanks a lot for bringing it up. Make some and drive it on over. I'd appreciate that. I will go now to Michael at 800-642-1234. Michael is calling from Oconomowoc. Michael, hi.
Hey, thanks for having this topic. I'm actually a physician in the area, and I routinely have been prescribing plant-based eating, do it personally, for over 7 years. Just my last patient, second last, I just prescribed this to help reversing his destiny for diabetes and high blood pressure. But I think that when you mentioned the tastiness and like, gosh, am I going to still enjoy food? One of the biggest things is something called the pleasure trap. When you're eating very high fat, high protein, high salt processed food, you're initially so used to those calorie dense foods that when you eat something that's lower calorie density, maybe veggies with vinegar, dressing with some quinoa, vegetables, fruit mixed in a salad, for example, it may seem initially not as tasty, but within a couple weeks, your taste buds will actually adapt. If you do this and you have high blood pressure, diabetes, it's extremely important to check your blood pressure a couple times a day because it's very good chance you're going to have to get off or reduce the dose of your medications while you're doing this because it's so effective.
Wow. Michael, have you worked with a lot of people to power through that first couple of weeks where they're maybe missing that fattier, high-calorie diet?
I think that one of my doctor colleagues has done this, and he sent me a text message 3 days in, and he's like, oh, I can't believe how much I miss cheese. And he teased me when I'd eaten the quinoa bean kale salad at a restaurant, and he'd eaten the steak. And he did change for health reasons, and he texted me 3 days in, and he said, I can't believe how much I miss cheese. And I said, hey, that's the cheese addiction. Just give it some time. And now he's doing it and himself and sharing it with his patients, too. So I think just recognizing it, it's kind of like telling somebody if they're on nicotine, you're going to have withdrawal. If you're, you know, don't be surprised. I think people kind of sabotage us. They're doing it for health reasons when they allow themselves to have a little bit of that. It actually makes the cravings even more intense. Kind of like if you're trying to quit smoking, studies show going cold turkey is more successful.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. So a doctor's perspective there. Kate, do you, I know you mostly focus on the cooking. Do you look into some of the health benefits of upping our plant intake?
Definitely. I actually did a year-long program. I'm a certified holistic nutrition health coach, and we learned all about that in the class that I took. So I definitely try to incorporate veggies, protein, fat, all of the basic components of a balanced meal into our recipes.
Michael, thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go now to David with us in Milwaukee. David, hello.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good. I understand you have a recipe for us, David.
Absolutely. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with bushmeat, but bushmeat is one of the traditional ways that the wonderful people of Africa find ways to obtain protein, either from little bush babies or lemurs or what have you, that they catch chimpanzees and monkeys. And what we have done, we have a restaurant here in Milwaukee where we're trying to provide bushmeat in a culturally aware and sensitive way, but using, you know, non-monkeys or non-chimps. So we're doing it with a variety of tofu and beans. We have a bean-based burger, but it's supposed to, and I've heard it does taste just like a chimpanzee.
Okay. I didn't know where you're going to go with that, David. We ended up with some veggie there. Okay. So, but like that idea of combining the soy ingredients like tofu and other veggies to create a textured meal, like maybe something like a burger sort of thing. Katie, is that something you've worked on?
Absolutely. We have a lot of vegetarian and vegan burger options on our website. We've experimented a lot with quinoa, brown rice, all sorts of lentils and black beans. There's really a lot of options for a lot of different flavor profiles.
We are talking to Katie Cotin and Kate Casby. They are the creators of Well Vegan and co-authors of the cookbook Frugal Vegan. We're talking about getting more plant-based foods into our diet. We've got one more recipe coming up. But first, we had a caller that couldn't stay on the line but says he's enjoyed a variety of vegan meals, including a few that used cauliflower in creative ways. Kate, what are some of the ways you like to use cauliflower in recipes?
Oh my gosh, the options are limitless. One of my favorites, and it's a recipe that we have on wellvegan.com, is Jamaican jerk cauliflower wings. So you basically just chop the cauliflower up into small pieces and coat them in a jerk seasoning and bake them and dip them in a creamy sauce. It's very good.
Oh, that's one of my favorites, yes.
And Katie, do you want to take another stab at cauliflower?
Oh, we've used it a lot. I feel like cauliflower is just having a day. Like the last few years, you can do all sorts of things with cauliflower. Kate and I really like to substitute at least half of any sort of like potato mash with cauliflower. That's one of our favorite kind of swaps for a little bit healthier, lighter eating.
Let's get to another recipe we have online that you sent us. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you mentioned, Katie, you were talking about pasta earlier, I think. And we've got this recipe for tomato basil cream pasta. All right, it's cream, but there's no cream in it. Where is it getting a creamy texture from?
Yeah, absolutely. So this one just started from like a basic recipe that I think I used to make from the Barefoot Contessa. She was always one of my favorites when I was eating vegetarian because she has a lot of good choices. But we decided to take her recipe, and instead of using the heavy cream, we swapped it out with some soaked cashews that have been blended up in the blender. And if you're a little short on time, Kate recently suggested that I simmer my cashews for a little while, just for like 15 to 20 minutes, and it'll soften them up to make them blendable if you forget to soak them overnight. But you can use cashews like that in a lot of different creamy recipes.
And then not all pasta, Kate, is vegan, right, if we're just buying dry pasta at the store?
Right. You have to read the ingredient label. Some pastas have egg in them, but really you should be just looking for wheat and water, basically. There should be a very simple pasta, or if you're going gluten-free, there's lots of great options like quinoa or brown rice pasta.
All right, I got a question for each of you. I know you're both more westerly. You got a little different climate going now, but you both have a Midwestern background. Let's start with you, Katie. Springtime vegetables, thinking in the Midwestern spring, what kind of things do you look forward to the most?
Oh, I really like asparagus.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of my favorites.
And what do you like to do with the asparagus? Somebody was talking about eating it raw in a salad on one of these Food Fridays recently.
You know what? I would be open to that. I usually blanch it real quick just to kind of improve the texture slightly. But yeah, I would like to try it raw as well.
And Kate, same question. Favorite springtime vegetables?
Ooh, asparagus is one of my favorites too. But I just recently got into peas. Not the kind of peas that come in a can, but just like fresh peas and steaming them. I keep them in a Tupperware in the refrigerator and just throw them on like pizzas and flatbreads and salads and pasta, pretty much anything. They add some great texture and protein.
In our last couple of minutes, Katie, can you give us some advice for someone who's thinking, even if they don't want to go full vegan, they want to, you know, at least start on that path? What are some starter tips for them?
Absolutely. Start with recipes you already make and you're comfortable with. Look for what that you're already making that's just accidentally vegan, and continue forward with that and grow from there.
And Kate, any other tips to add before I let you go?
Keep it simple. You don't have to go out and buy fancy fake meat. Really just stick to the basics and surround your meals around vegetables and fruits, and you're good to go.
All right, we'll leave it there. Katie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Kate, thanks for joining us on Central Time.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Katie Cotin and Kate Casby. They're the creators of the website Well Vegan. They join us for this week's edition of Food Friday. You can find info about their cookbook, Frugal Vegan, and more recipes at wellvegan.com. And you can take a look at the recipes we've talked about today. You can find those and lots of past Food Friday recipes over at wpr.org/Food Friday. We had that tomato basil cream pasta, lentil and wild rice salad with vegetables, and pancakes with roasted bananas, maple roasted bananas. That sounds pretty good all by itself. The federal judge blocked rules this week in Arkansas and Kentucky that would require certain people to work as part of a Medicaid expansion program. While Arkansas was the first state to have this type of work policy, that state and Kentucky weren't the only ones making moves in that direction. Similar rules exist in Indiana and New Hampshire, and Wisconsin is also among a small number of states that have received federal approval for those requirements but haven't put those into practice yet. Now, lawmakers and policy analysts alike are weighing next steps in these cases and what it means. Donna Friedsam is a researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Population Health Institute. Donna, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
So the judge made this ruling saying, in effect, these work rules got in the way of the core goal of Medicaid, providing medical coverage to those in need. What's your takeaway on these rulings?
Right. So Judge Blasberg used very strong language, actually, in stating that that CMS, the federal agency that approved these rules, acted in a way that was arbitrary and capricious in approving these rules, and were in violation of the core objectives of the Medicaid program, which is to extend medical coverage to the needy. So that language is pretty directive in sending a message to the federal agency, at least that how this one federal judge views these work requirements in seeing them as not being permitted under federal law.
Now, the Republican governor of Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson, is calling for the Trump administration to appeal the ruling. Is it likely that this is not the final ruling on work requirements under Medicaid?
Yes, this is definitely not the final ruling. I would expect to see a number of appeals related to work requirements and litigation in other states as well.
I know it probably varies from state to state, but in general, how have states been putting these work requirements into practice?
So there's many states that have proposed various forms of work requirements, and only a few that have approved versions of the work requirements, and virtually none that have actually implemented yet. Arkansas and Kentucky being the ones that had begun some form of implementation. So what we know is that it's very difficult to get these work requirement provisions underway, and they have been subject to a lot of legal dispute. And so we don't have a lot of experience yet in knowing whether these are even viable programs.
Who do they tend to apply to? What group of people would be affected by these requirements?
Again, every state has its own version of these requirements. In other states, they apply to all adults below a certain age, but whether it's below age 50 or below age 60. Wisconsin's provisions apply to what is frequently referred to as childless adults or adults without dependent children, and they would be adults between the ages of 19 and 49, so under age 50.
Talking to Donna Friedsam from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Population Health Institute, looking at a court ruling blocking work requirements for people receiving Medicaid in two states, Arkansas and Kentucky. Let's bring this home, Donna. Where is Wisconsin when it comes to, we've got these federally approved requirements. They aren't in place yet. Where are we right now?
So the decision that occurred this week is only binding with regard to the two states that were in question in that court, which were Arkansas and Kentucky. But the language could be persuasive on other states that may be facing litigation, and if litigation were to occur in Wisconsin. But for now, if Wisconsin wants to go ahead with its waiver, it will go ahead, and unless CMS tells it otherwise. And so currently state law says that the state must implement the waiver within a year of approval, so it would need to be implemented by November 1st. And unless CMS instructs the state otherwise, and CMS would do so based on how they decide to react, depending on the judges, how they want to react to the judge's language. But it's also important to recognize that Wisconsin's waiver language is quite different than other state waivers with regard to the structure of work requirements. So, the way Wisconsin has it structured, the concern is much more related, I think, to confusion around who is eligible, who is required to participate in these requirements and the like. And we're likely to see people losing coverage or attrition from coverage more related to confusion or administrative burdens for compliance than we are because people are not complying.
Under Wisconsin's policy, again, not yet implemented, what would someone have to do, that childless adult, say, have to do to establish that they were meeting the requirement for work or similar comparable activity?
Well, Wisconsin's waiver has it that people would have 48 months of eligibility available to them, and if they participate in various work or community engagement requirements within those 48 months, it essentially stops the clock on that 48 month limit. And once they reach those 48 months of eligibility while not participating in those requirements, then they lose eligibility for a 6 month period, and then they may reapply for coverage. So there's nobody in Wisconsin that would immediately lose coverage, but during that period, they're going to need to report about what kinds of things they are or are not participating in. And the state is going to need to make significant investments in various kinds of reporting mechanisms for people to tell the state what kinds of activities they are or are not engaging in. And so the state can track during that 48-month period what is going on. And that's really the question for the state, is what kinds of administrative costs it's going to sink into the program, considering that there is this threat of litigation and possibility that the federal government might have to roll back these work requirements entirely.
One of the arguments in favor of these requirements is the idea that, okay, for this group, maybe it's childless adults, able-bodied is a phrase that's often used. For people who could be working, the argument is maybe they should be working. Supporters of work requirements say they don't want this to be a Medicaid handout. They don't want it to be a disincentive to work. Given that we haven't done this really in states yet, is there any kind of evidence to suggest that it might work that way?
We don't really have good evidence at this point to understand how these work requirements function. What we know is that most adults who are enrolled in Medicaid are currently working or attached to households where there is an employed adult. Those who are not working, most of them report that they are home taking care of a ill or sick family member, or that they are temporarily ill or disabled themselves, or they're in school. So it looks like many people will be subject to various exemptions to the work requirements, and that there will be a minority of the currently eligible people who would be actually subject to the work requirements. So what we believe, or what many believe, is that the issue with losing eligibility in these kinds of programs is not necessarily that people are not able to or willing to comply with the work requirements, and in fact, many people are already working. Rather, the concern is that, like I said, these administrative burdens, or the what other people refer to as ordeal mechanisms, are enough to make it difficult for people to maintain their eligibility and their coverage. And that's what we saw in Arkansas, is just simply the difficulty of people in reporting their participation in various activities.
In our last few moments, I understand Governor Evers, in his budget proposal, wants to get out of this waiver and end these work requirements. What are you watching for there as this budget process moves along?
Well, that's really going to depend. I mean, his budget, his proposed budget does eliminate many of the provisions of the existing waiver, and instead proposes Medicaid expansion up to 138% of the federal poverty level, as the Affordable Care Act would have defined it, and provides for taking more federal money. So, but it will really depend on how the Republican legislature wants to handle his budget, and it seems unlikely that they're going to go for what the governor had proposed in terms of the rollback of the waiver. But we'll really have to see how the state and the legislature views these court decisions, and whether they want the state to make these administrative investments, given the threat of litigation and what might happen in the future.
Donna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Donna Friedsam is a researcher and health policy programs director at the UW-Madison Population Health Institute. She joined us for a look at recent moves at the federal level involving work rules for Medicaid recipients. Imagine this: you're killing time on Facebook or Instagram, and someone you follow has a cool new bag, or they post pictures of an amazing vacation. They did the cool thing, they bought the cool thing, you like it, and then suddenly you want it too. And if you have disposable income, you might have actually purchased that thing that was so cool when you saw it on social media. If you've ever done that, take comfort in the fact that you are not alone. A recent study found that social media has a pretty significant impact on how and what we spend our money on. David Hirschleifer is a distinguished professor of finance and economics at the University of California, Irvine. David, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob. It's great to be here.
Well, introduce us to this concept of visibility bias. What does that mean?
So visibility bias, in the context of people saving or spending, is the idea that when you buy something or you spend, that that's more visible to other people than when you do nothing in particular, when you don't make a purchase. So, for example, if I see a car that's parked in my neighbor's driveway, that's really noticeable to me. That's highly visible that they're willing to spend a lot of money. But if there's nothing parked in the driveway, I don't notice that at all.
And that could have an impact on us. It would, I guess, normalize spending. It makes it look like everybody is buying things, but it doesn't make it look like everybody else is saving money, because we can't see that.
Absolutely, Rob. So when I'm eating out at a restaurant, I see a lot of other people eating out at a restaurant, and I may not stop to think about all the people who are having an inexpensive meal at home. The same thing when I'm at the airport and I see a long line in front of the Starbucks, and I don't think about the people who are paying only 10 cents for a cup of coffee at home. So that can cause people to overestimate how much others are willing to spend. And it may cause me to forget about people who are staying home and having a staycation instead of going on an expensive trip. So that can create skewed perceptions about how important saving is. So when people are trying to figure out how much to save for the future, there's a lot of uncertainty. It's a really hard thing to figure out. What is the risk that I'll have a job loss in the future, or expensive health problems, or a disability? And when people are faced with hard problems, they often take social cues. So they look and see, what are other people doing? And that can sometimes work pretty well if the other people are well informed. But unfortunately, when it comes to saving for the future, the other people may be just as clueless as I am. And it's even worse than that, because it's not just that they lack information, but also I'm getting a skewed observation about how much they are really saving or consuming because of this visibility bias.
And I imagine this has always been there, but is there more of this social information coming at us through social media?
Yes. So I think social media is greatly intensifying social observation. So the number of people that you can observe and see, hear about on Facebook or by Instagram postings about their eating out or going on it on an expensive trip. And especially, it increases the visibility bias. So if I'm visiting my next-door neighbor at home, then I may see them drinking that cheap cup of coffee or having that staycation. But if I'm only getting the information from social media, well, Facebook is going to give me a notification when they do a posting, not when they're doing nothing in particular. And the posting is going to occur when there's an exciting new product purchase, bought a new car, went on a vacation. So that's going to skew perceptions even more.
Right.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I'm more likely to post, hey, here's this exciting vacation photo, maybe from the vacation I took last month. I'm not even on it now. I'm not going to make a picture of me transferring money into my savings account.
That's true. That's true. In fact, it's even considered a bit socially undesirable sometimes to talk about, wow, I'm saving so much money. Look how much I put in the bank. And it certainly is not as engaging as a posting or even in a phone call. So we tend to think that the internet is the new modern thing. And one might think that that visibility bias was born with social media, but it really comes from electronic communication more generally. So a few decades ago, you had plunging costs of long-distance phone calls. You had the rise of cell phones, later of smartphones, the rise of cable television with home shopping stations and vivid depictions of product purchases. And so it's really been a continuing process where electronic communications have made it more and more observations of what people want to report about what's happening, which tends to be the exciting things like consumption activities, instead of the spontaneous physical observation of people that one is in immediate contact with.
So we see ads all the time on TV or on billboards or online, for that matter. Is seeing our friends, people in our social network, consuming, buying stuff going to have more of an influence on us than these ads that we might be a little more skeptical of?
Yes. Well, of course, everyone knows that the advertisements are intended to induce us to make purchases and sometimes to try to manipulate us. And so we have a built-in resistance to advertising. Advertisement can get around those barriers, but people are placed much greater credence on the observation, on direct observation of what other people are doing. And so other people are like walking billboards. When we see them consume, we feel, okay, that's a choice that a person has actually made. It's not just an advertiser who's trying to trick me into making a purchase.
Now, I think I'm probably like a lot of people, and I think I'm immune to this sort of thing, but, I'm a board game nerd, for one thing, and I've seen other people online buying a particular game, and I just bought that game last week. I might not have done it if I hadn't seen all the buzz. Is this something that's just going to affect us without us really consciously thinking about it?
I believe that this does affect people without conscious introspection. Humans are social animals, and we observe what other people do. And for almost everyone, that influences us. It influences our beliefs, and it influences our idea of what is a good way to live, what is a sensible way to do things. And because of that, there's a self-feeding kind of process that goes on here. There's a self-reinforcing feedback where I observe others. Because of visibility bias, I think they're consuming more than they really are. That causes me to consume more and save less. But now I become a model for observation by other people. So now the other people really are seeing me consume a lot. And above and beyond that, there's that visibility bias on top of that. And so my increased consumption loops back to increasing consumption by them. And so the overall feedback effect can be extremely strong.
All right. Assuming our goal is to have more people save a little more money, live more within their means, and we see that this visibility bias is an obstacle to that, what do we do about it?
Well, I think that one thing is just to keep in mind when you see your friends going on expensive vacations, just to remind yourself that, well, wait, I may have some friends who are holding on to their 15-year-old car and haven't bought a new car. And just remind yourself of the things that are less visible, of your friends that are staying home and aren't eating out tonight. And so just being aware of the visibility bias can be helpful for taking the social media reports with a grain of salt. Now, at the policy level, our theory has a novel implication, which is that you can help cure the problem of undersaving by truthful disclosure of how much people are actually saving and how much they're spending. So people are overestimating how much others are consuming. So if you just report accurately to them, here's the actual spending rate that other people have, that will cause them to consume less. After we wrote our paper, there was a new study that tested this idea using a smartphone app. And what they did was they had people report their expenses automatically through the smartphone app. And they looked at people who were overspenders, who were spending heavily relative to the average. And they looked at underspenders, who were spending relatively less relative to the average person. And then they disclosed to people where they stood, whether they were overspenders or underspenders. And then on average, the overspenders cut their spending rate relative to income by 3% on average. And the underspenders increased their spending when they learned that they were spending less than others, but they increased it by only 1%. So on average, the overspending, the spending decreased. And that's very consistent with this visibility bias effect, that when people are overestimating on average how much others are spending, and when they learn that average spending is less than they expected, on average people are cutting back on their consumption.
Interesting. We'll leave it there. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a pleasure.
David Hirschleifer is Mirage Chair in Business Growth and Distinguished Professor of Finance for the University of California at Irvine. He joins today to talk about an emerging spending phenomenon called visibility bias and how people are convinced to spend and buy more by the people they follow on social media. Has this happened to you? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Is it a brilliant food innovation or food sacrilege? You make the call. A tweet from a St. Louis workplace went viral. A guy brought bagels into work. That's cool. But he had them sliced not like bagels. As a picture showed, instead of slicing them once the long way, you know, cutting them in half like you would with a bagel, he had them cut into strips from the top down. So they were cut like little slices of a little bread loaf. And he wrote, quote, "Today I introduced my coworkers to the St. Louis secret of ordering bagels bread sliced. It was a hit." So this is the internet age. There was, of course, an angry backlash, especially from New York City. The New York Police Department's chief of detectives replied, "Thank you for reporting this crime, but we only serve New York City where this would never happen." There's a lot of similar stuff out there. There were defenders, too, of the bread sliced bagels who pointed out that you get more surface area of bagel to hold more cream cheese. I don't think I would do this myself. I'll go with the traditional bagel cutting style. But I'm not going to judge. You buy the food, you get to do whatever you want with it. If somebody put out bread sliced bagels at work, would I knock over the table? No. Would I eat them? Yeah, sure. But, you know, gripe about what you got to gripe about. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.